Thanks very much, Kathy, and thanks to all of you for coming along this evening. So yeah, this is me. I'm Duncan Murdoch. As Kathy said, I'm a Lever Hugh Merlin Career Fellow here at the museum. So I wanted to start this talk this evening with this piece of art that Kathy mentioned that features in the First Impressions Trail that was put together with the Oxford Printmakers Collective. So this features here Professor Trilobite giving a lecture downstairs in the main court of this museum some 500 million years in the future. And he poses this question, does evolution go round in circles? Now this piece of art, as I say, by John Dew, it was inspired by this cartoon from 1830 called Awful Changes by Henri de Labèche, where a similar professor, Professor Ichthyosaurus here, is giving a similar lecture in the future about the repetitive nature of evolution. And this work in itself was inspired by lectures given by William Buckland. Here he is drawn giving one of his famous lectures. Many of the objects that he's using as props thought to be part of our collections. You can find out a lot more about Buckland in the case downstairs by the T-Rex. Now, I've not brought all of this up to compare myself to Buckland, or indeed Professors Ichthyosaurus or Trilobite. I wouldn't be so bold as that. And I can prove that because, as Kathy alluded to, I do feature in this piece of art. So this little guy here is me. So this flattering miniature of me posing in shorts and a polo shirt, which is the attire that you would more regularly see me in, but I thought I'd make an effort for you this evening, so I hope you appreciate that. But that's not why I brought this piece of art up. It's more because it encapsulates two of the themes that I want to touch upon in the next 45 minutes or so. And that is twofold. First of all, this idea of a repetitive or cyclical nature of events in evolution, and secondly, how important skeletons have been to our understanding of the history of life. So skeletons are here wonderfully depicted, ranging from the skull of a skeleton of a human to this strange whale dinosaur creature that Professor Trilobite has put together. And of course, the skeletons themselves of this rogues gallery of Cambrian creatures. Now, I'm an evolutionary biologist and a geologist. So that means there's always two things on my mind. First of all, there's the tree of life. So here is one version of the tree of life. Here is a UR here arrow. Now I'm going to feature in the rest of my talk a number of different trees drawn in different ways. So in case you're not familiar with them, they're very simply, they draw lines of common descent between animals or any organisms or groups of organisms. So Darwin up here, he shares the last most common ancestor with the chimp, united in a group, the apes. This is to the exclusion of their next closest relative here. This is a golden lion tamarind. And then if we keep adding progressively deeper branches into the tree, we can build this diagram of a hypothesis of a series of hierarchically nested groups until we've encapsulated the entire a diversity of life. So it is at least possible to draw a tree of all life, both living and extinct. So the second thing I want you to bear in mind, as I say, I'm also a geologist, is that the Earth is old. And we can only really put together the history of life on Earth by putting the sequence of events represented in the rocks in the right order. So much like the paperwork that might be piling up on your desk, it certainly is on mine, the oldest things tend to get buried beneath the more recent things as they come in. And that's just the same with the rock record. And the period of time that I'm going to be focusing on is represented here by this red line. It's the start of the Phanerozoic Aeon, so the time of life, and represented here, it's a big change in the number and diversity of fossils that we see in the rock record. So in the Precambrian, this is the time before this red line, there is very, very, a few fossils, and they are predominantly soft-bodied, and then we see this big increase in the rock record. So to give you a bit of context, T-Rex, like the one we have down in the court here in the Cretaceous, is closer in time to the invention of the iPhone than he is to a Stegosaurus. So that just gives you some idea of the length of time. But the time that I'm going to be talking about is nearly three times as old as even that. But I don't want to give you too much of a false impression of the antiquity of these events, because actually this timescale, the keen-eyed amongst you will have noticed, isn't scaled very well. In fact, if we rescale it, most of Earth history is in fact the Precambrian. So the Earth, as I've mentioned before, is very old, some 4.5 billion years or so at the last count. And this event is a relatively recent occurrence in the history of life. So that's the context that I want you to think about all of these events in. So let's zoom in then on this red line. So it separates two periods of time that geologists call the Cambrian and the Ediacaran. And the Cambrian named after the Latinized version of Wales, which in Wales there's lots of mountains of rocks of Cambrian age. And the Ediacaran is named similarly after a range of hills in South Australia, which are of Ediacaran age. So the Ediacaran has become famous in recent years for this array of weird and wonderful soft-bodied creatures that have been discovered in exceptionally preserved sites, some of which you can see on display in First Animals exhibition. Now, these are very difficult to place on the Tree of Life. Increasingly, they're thought to be probable animals, but they're fundamentally different in the way they're constructed to the animals we see today. If we step over the boundary into the Cambrian, although things still are a little bit weird, they're much more familiar. We see all of the animal groups that we find around today, we can find in rocks of Cambrian age here, represented by this reconstruction of the Chengjiang biota in Yunnan province. We've been lucky enough to have on loan 55 specimens from this locality, which you can also see in First Animals if you haven't had a chance to do so. And then straddling the boundary is a mixed assemblage of creatures where we still have these weird soft body things like this Svartpuntia persisting, but we're getting the first glimpses that something has changed. And here we've got these creatures here, which are some of the first animals to have hard skeletons. Now, this change from a world dominated by strange soft-bodied things to the rock record teeming with the skeletons, shells, teeth, bones, etc. of animals has not been newly discovered. This has been known about for some time. It's often called Darwin's dilemma, because he puzzled as to how what we now know to be the Precambrian completely lacked fossils, as was known when this was written in 1859. Now, we know that there were indeed living creatures swarming in the Precambrian, but the fundamental change that happened was that none of these creatures had hard skeletons, so their chance of getting in the fossil record was much, much smaller. So really, the Cambrian explosion is, in part at least, a story of how animals became much more readily fossilizable. So for the remainder of my talk, I'm going to borrow an approach from another great scientist. So this is a character from a book by Andrea Beattie called Ada Twist, Scientist. And she baffled her parents with her insatiable curiosity. And she, as it said in the book, she started with why, and then what, how, and when. And by bedtime, she came back to why once again. So hopefully, by your bedtime, we'll have come back to why once again. I'll follow the approach of Ada. So first of all, why are skeletons important? So you're probably thinking of skeletons like these. So this is the bony skeleton of a vertebra like you or I, or big skeleton, little skeleton, or Rex the dog, and indeed all the vertebrates around us. But skeletons are much more diverse than that in terms of their shape, what they're made of, what they're doing. So here we have just a very small snapshot of animal skeletons of all different flavors. And if we take a look at a slimmed down version of that Tree of Life, so here we have a selection of major groups of animals plotted against time. And if we look at the distribution of skeletons that we see today, and also in the fossil record, we see that skeletons are everywhere, all across the animal tree of life. And I've tried to indicate how roughly how diverse the different groups are in terms of their types and uses of skeletons, and the mollusks probably being the champions of animal skeletons today. And skeletons give animals the opportunity to do things that they might otherwise not have been able to do. So whether that's things like more efficient prey capture, like this lobster here, or withstanding predation or harsh environments, like this oyster, or these barnacles and limpets that spend part of their day exposed by the tides, or whether it's burrowing into the sediment, like this large bivalve, or indeed building giant reefs, like corals do today. All of this is done by building skeletons, or biomineralization, as it's known. So let's move on to the what and the when. So we'll return to this diagram here. So again, we've got a selection of some of the most important animal groups plotted against time. And you can see here, this is that red line separating the Cambrian from the Precambrian that I showed you in previous slides. And here is the known fossil records of these different groups. And you can see they all appear at some point in the first half of the Cambrian. Now you'll notice that these lines extend back into the Cambrian with no fossil record. So these divergence times have been estimated using a method called the molecular clock. So essentially it takes the accrued genetic differences between two sister groups of animals and uses something about our understanding of the time that it takes for those changes to accrue. And then you can use that to work out how old their last common ancestor must have been. Now, at first glance, you might think, well, this doesn't fit with the fossil record. But actually, when you think about it, it does. You would expect the divergences to predate the earliest fossil. But by definition, these divergences can't postdate the earliest fossil. And we know that there are biases, for example, in the fossil record. But we do also know that this event at the base of the Cambrian is real. There are lots of rocks that have been looked at of pre-Cambrian age that don't contain these recognisable complex animal fossils. So let's unpack this a little bit further. So here is essentially the same diagram. Again, we have time all the way up to the present in this case. Here is that red line and a tree broken down into more groups. You don't need to worry about the details. And then behind this tree is plotted diversity. So the numbers of different phyla, so that's the biggest bin that we classify animals into, or classes in yellow. So this is just the subdivisions of animal phyla. And hopefully you can see that there's very little going on in the Ediacaran. And then we have this huge increase in diversity. Almost all of the animal phyla are recognized down in the Cambrian. And by the end of the next period, the Ordovician here, the start of the next period, the Ordovician, virtually all animal classes are found. So we have this huge increase in diversity, and with very little change in the subsequent half a billion years. But if we zoom in further on this window of time, so here the time scales flipped around, so older rocks down here, younger rocks up here again. Here is this this red line, we can see that there's actually a succession of different groups of animals represented by different fossils that we see going through this period of time that we call the Ediacaran to Cambrian transition. So if we start here with the so-called Ediacaran biota, so that's the animals that lived during the Ediacaran. I won't spend very much time talking about these, but they are these strange creatures, many of which are probable animals that are constructed in a fundamentally different way. But the crucial thing in terms of what I want to get across is that they are entirely soft-bodied. And then right at the end of the Ediacaran, we get the first animals to build skeletons. So here is this strange baby's rattle-shaped creature called Narmacalathus. It's not clear where this creature fits in the tree of life, but we do know that it's using minerals to build a skeleton. So this is a thin section cut through a piece of rock, and here is the mineral calcite that it's used to build the skeleton that has been reconstructed here on the right. Then there are things that are a little bit more familiar at the very latest part of the Ediacaran and into the Cambrian. This is a creature called Cloudina. So this is a series of little ice cream cones stacked into each other, again built from the mineral calcite that powers probably something that looks a little bit like a coral sitting in the very top of this little cup. Now these are really important fossils because they indicate a change in the way that animals are arranging themselves and arranging the environment that they live. So these are thought to be the first potential reef building animals. So previously anything resembling a reef was built by single-celled creatures like cyanobacteria. But here we have genuine animals building the first potential reef-like structure. So here is our bunch of Cloudina, and here's some little Narmacalassus clusters. So if we return to this diagram, when we step over the boundary, we see a massive increase in this green part of the diagram here. So these are a series of small in size. They're typically less than a millimeter. They are shelly and they are fossils. So unimaginative paleontologists that we are, these are called the small shelly fossils. They're known to their friend as the small smelly fossils because that's, you know, more entertaining. So in contrast to Cloudina and Narmacalathus, we have this huge diversity of small shelly fossils in the lowest Cambrian. All sorts of different forms and also an array of different types of minerals. So we have these many different tube-like things, little pixie hat-shaped things, star-shaped things, this beautiful little net. These are clearly recognisable as valves of a group of animal called a brachiopod. These are thought to be the first mollusks, things like slugs and snails. So these small shelly fossils can be put all across the animal tree of life. And here's just a little snapshot of a few of them. And they built fundamentally more complex ecosystems. So we've now got the occupation of going up into the water column. So these early sponges known as archaeocyathans are creating new ecological niches, burrowing down into the sediment. And much of this was facilitated by the origin of skeletonization. And even in these exceptionally preserved deposits like the Chenjiang biota that are celebrated for preserving their soft parts, we see a whole range of different animals that had hard parts as well. So in this snapshot from our Chenjiang reconstruction, we can see sponges over here with little glass spicules. We've got brachiopods with shells made out of calcium phosphate, just like our teeth and bones. We've got trilobites with hard calcium carbonate shells. And we have this little worm that has these little biomineralized sclerites sitting in it. So we virtually no ecosystem is absent of things with skeletons once we get past the Ediacaran. So how do we use fossils to try and understand this time period? So occasionally, if we're lucky, you will find completely articulated skeletons. So most of those small shelly fossils that I just showed you are the bits and pieces of the skeleton after they've fallen apart. This beautiful fossil here from the Sirius Passet, Lagerstätten in Greenland. So this specimen is on display around the corner. So if you haven't seen it, please do go and have a look. So it's a little slug-like creature with two big shells, one at either end, and then a whole series of little plates. So by finding things like this, we're able to put back together the jigsaw of what these kinds of animals might have been and explain what some of these small shelly fossils are. But these finds are extremely rare, so we have to find other ways of unpicking the information from these tiny fossils. So one way that I've been doing since my PhD at the University of Bristol, and I'm continuing to do that now, along with other colleagues here in Oxford, There's a technique called SRXTM, or synchrotron radiation X-ray tomographic microscopy. You don't need to worry about what that means. I'll explain it in a minute. But I'm fortunate enough to be able to go to this big donut-shaped building about an hour outside of Zurich in Switzerland, called the Swiss Light Source. So this is what they would like you to believe it looks like. And this is a photo from their website of these happy, engaged scientists discussing their discoveries on the way to drink a skinny latte or something. And this is how it actually appears most of the time while you're working there, because we run the machine 24 hours a day. And as I was a PhD student when I started this, I was at the bottom of the ladder, so I ended up with an awful lot of the night shifts. So once you get inside this donut-shaped building, you go to a little hutch, and the one that we've used is called Tomcat. Now this is, I think, wins the prize for one of the worst backronyms in history. So Tomcat stands for Tomographic Microscopy and Coherent Radiology Experiments. So I had nothing to do with naming it, but it does make a particularly catchy name and quite a nice logo to put into talks. So there's a little model of the Swiss Light Source there. So essentially, as I say, you have this donut-shaped building. Inside you have a ring surrounded by concrete where they accelerate using big bending magnets, electrons. And as they fall around this circle, they lose energy in the form of X-rays. And these get put into a storage ring and then funneled down these beam lines into experimental stations. So here is another demonstration of what that looks like. So here is the X-ray light coming down, hitting the sample of interest. There's an interaction between the X-rays and the sample, and then you collect those X-rays on the other side. So here is what it looks like inside the hutch. So here is where the X-rays come in down this tube. And then there's a whole series of things, only about 5% of which I understand what they are and know what they're called. But fortunately, I don't need to worry about that. All I need to do is turn up with my sample and put it here on the sample stage. So again, so this is where the X-rays come in. And then you have the sample here, and then you have a detector here known as a scintillator that receives the X-rays after they've been slowed down to a greater or a lesser extent by the material that you've put in front of them. Then these X-rays are turned into visible light, and they hit a mirror and they get picked up by a camera. The reason that they have to go through this 90 degree turn is that cameras don't like to be exposed to X-rays for long periods of time. So visible light here, and then it goes up into the camera. And then, unless you have a penchant for being irradiated, it's best to operate the machine from the other side of the big heavy door. So we have, this is the software that we use to set up the experiments. And then ultimately you end up with this 3D volume that you can peer inside the individual fossil. So this little small Shelley fossil here is about 300 microns, that's 300 thousandths of a millimeter long. And you're looking at slices through it, less than a millimeter between each slice. And you can then cut that specimen virtually in any orientation. So no fossils are harmed in the making of these this data, except, of course, the ones that you sneeze on and they blow off the desk. That's the perils of working with such small specimens. And then we're able to unpick each individual growth layer of these tiny fossils. So again, these are all around about half a millimeter or less in length. And you can see here each one of these layers was laid down as the animal grew this little piece of skeleton. So we can use this evidence to try and put back together the history of of these animals when they're alive, where they sit in the tree of life, what these animals might have been doing with their skeletons. So I'd like to return now to the why. So why did skeletons evolve is probably the most obvious question to ask. But that's not the question that I'm going to answer, because I think that's kind of outside the realms of scientific inquiry, really. So what I'm going to ask is, why did skeletons evolve then? when they did. So was the were the conditions just right? Is there a sort of Goldilocks effect going on as to why we get this sudden explosion in skeletons? So here is a diagram that tries to get across some of the different aspects of what drove this diversification of animals. And I want to, there's many different things going on. So in the early Cambrian, it was a period of very high sea level. So much of the continents were flooded. So this results in erosion, putting lots of chemicals into the seawater, things like calcium and phosphorus that are vital for building minerals that we need to build skeletons with. Also, it opens up the amount of shallow shelf. So most of the diversity of the oceans is here in the shallow shelf rather than in the deep seas. We know that there was the evolution of burrowing took place during this time period, which drew oxygen down into the sediments, increasing the available ecospace for animals to occupy. But what I want to focus on is tucked in here, which you may not be able to read. Some animals begin to mineralize their skeletons. And something that's intrinsically linked with that is here, is the genetic complexity of animals increased. So if you'll forgive me, I'm going to briefly take us on a little diversion into developmental biology. So this is a summary of a study that's a few years old now, looking at the genes involved in building mother-of-pearl or nacre in modern mollusks. So we've got an abalone and a pearl oyster here. And they also compared that with the genes involved in building the skeleton of the purple sea urchin, or more precisely, the larvae of a purple sea urchin. Now, these two mollusks, although they look quite similar, their last common ancestor is somewhere down way at the base of the Cambrian. And the last common ancestor of sea urchins and mollusks is definitely prior to the Cambrian. So it's much, much later on. We can argue over the dates, but they're rough guide. And they found that these two different mollusk groups have independently evolved the ability to lay down mother of pearl. So as you might think, well, you only want to invent mother of pearl once, as it were, but it seems that that at least in these two groups of deeply diverging mollusks, there's multiple independent origins of this tissue in their skeletons. But they found that the genes that they did share, these two mollusks, were also shared with the purple sea urchin. Now, we know that their last common ancestor predates the origin of skeletons. We can know that from the rock record. So what they were suggesting was that these genes must have been present in their last common ancestor and doing something different. And they were independently exapted, is the word that developmental biologists would use, independently used for building skeletons in these three different lineages. And this has been coined the biomineralization toolkit hypothesis, that animals already had all the tools they needed to build skeletons before the origin of skeletons themselves. So there's numerous other studies finding similar toolkits, in this case comparing echinoderms, so that includes the sea urchin and vertebrates, the group to which we belong. So echinoderms have a skeleton in the very outer layers of their epidermis that's built out of calcium carbonate, but their nearest relatives are the in terms of animals with skeletons are the vertebrates. So we have an internal skeleton made of calcium phosphate. So very, very different arrangements. They have a particular tissue called stereome. We have a range of different tissues. You'll recognize bone, enamel, and dentine in your teeth, for example. So as you might expect, they found that the genes involved were not the same, but they found that the deep down at the bottom of the chain of events, a chain of molecular events, you do find similarities in the genes involved in building our skeletons and that of the sea urchin. So they found an extensive common biomineralization toolkit. So you might be thinking, well, how does a why does the paleontologist care about this sort of thing? Well, we can use the fossil record as well as the record of modern organisms to test the assumptions of what we should see in the history of life predicted by this hypothesis. So there's three things that we should see. First of all, we should see skeletons evolving many different times independently. But we also should see some evidence of this inherited framework of genes, but also an inherited soft scaffold onto which to build those skeletons. And then we should see this pattern of repeated pattern of skeletons getting more and more complex as they gain these novel genes that are involved in building them. So if you remember that although so mother of pearl is an extremely highly controlled tissue, it's very, very carefully laid down. There's an image of mother of pearl in the exhibition. You can see just on the very smallest level how tightly controlled these tissues are, and that's the result of a very complex set of developmental mechanisms that's evolved since its origin deep down in the Cambrian. So what can fossils and molecules do to inform this? So first of all, multiple independent origins of the skeleton. So I don't expect you to be able to read deliberately. I didn't want you to read the details of this diagram. All you need to know is that here's that red line again. So this is the Precambrian-Cambrian boundary, and this is the whole of the Cambrian and the subsequent period known as the Ordovician. And these are the stratigraphic ranges. So that's the ages of the rocks that we find a whole host of different fossils with skeletons. And they're color-coded based on the mineral that they use to build those skeletons. And then we can add into that the living groups and where they originate deep down in the Cambrian Ordovician. And then we can add on to that the tree of relationships of all of these creatures. So what I want you to focus in on is the very first two portions of the Cambrian. Slices of rocks get given names so that geologists can talk about them and know exactly what time period you're interested in. But some of them are yet to be formalized. So formalized names get names like the Fortunian, and the second stage is yet to be formally described. So it's just called Cambrian Stage 2. So hopefully you can see that we don't see a single origin of a skeleton down here, and then a diversification of all of the different skeleton building groups. Instead, we've got multiple different origins at subtly different times through this period, from the latest Ediacaran through to the earliest part of the Cambrian, and a whole jumble of different mineral systems being used. So these colours are not grouped at all. We've got reds and blues and greens and greys and blacks all mixed together. So the fossil record is telling us that skeletons evolved many times independently in lots of different groups across the tree of life, but during the same window of time. So second then, do we see any evidence for an inherited organic scaffold and this inherited genetic toolkit? So amazingly, yes, we do. So there's this study that was published recently. So hopefully you'll recognize Cloudina. So here are some other creatures from the same time period with skeletons. And down here, these are remarkably similar looking fossils, but they are entirely soft-bodied. So there's direct evidence for potential soft-bodied precursors for these skeletonized or skeleton-building creatures, actually in the rock record. In other places as well, there's this animal discovered from the Chenjiang. It's from a weird group of animals called the Chancellurids. They're essentially a plastic bag-shaped organism with little star-shaped bits of skeleton studded all around them. But this one is naked. It doesn't have these mineralized plates, but it has. You can see the remnants of their organic counterpart. So this is a potential for an organic precursor of this weird group of animals that built skeletons. And then moving on to our own skeleton, it's thought that Bone is derived via the calcification of cartilage. So if you look at the skeleton of a shark, for example, some of the cartilage is calcified, is hard, and some of it is not. So some of it is entirely soft. And vertebrates are unique amongst animals in that they have undergone a series of what are known as whole genome duplication events. So that's where the entire genome has been taken and copied out again and kept. And this has happened multiple times. So we have multiple copies of whole suites of genes. And it's thought that this added complexity to the machinery for building skeletons. So we see an increase in more and more complex tissues. So here are different ranges of different skeletal tissues and different vertebrates. And there's also evidence for this organic scaffold. So this little critter here, only a few tens of millimeters long, is called Amphioxus. It's known as a cephalochordate. So along with sea squirts, Amphioxus is an invertebrate chordate. So that's the group that we belong to, but they are our nearest sisters of things without a backbone. So we know they're related to us because they have this stiffened rod that goes that runs along the back, and then they also have features in the head. They have these pharyngeal gill slits. Now the Amphioxus is also known as the Lancelet. So there's this cartoon here of Sir Lancelet in the search for the holy gill. So this is the origin of gill structures in vertebrates can be seen in the Amphioxus. But what I want to draw your attention here is that are these cols here. So this is the tissue collagen, which is a complex organic molecule that's the precursor for all of our skeleton, and it's present here in Amphioxus today. Even though they have no hard parts whatsoever, they're entirely soft, they have collagen, which is a potential precursor molecule for building skeletons. So this is perhaps evidence for an independent origin of vertebrate skeletal tissues with a pre-existing more organic skeleton and this molecular framework. So then the third assumption of this hypothesis is that we should see more and more complexity and control in skeletons as they're built. So this is just a little piece of that diagram that I showed you. These are the mollusks. So they are bivalves, things like cockles and mussels, gastropods, slugs and snails, and sea slugs and sea snails, scaphopods or razor shells, cephalopods, things like ammonites, but also squid and octopus, and then some lesser known groups, the monoplacophorans here. So these are known as the conchifera or the shelled mollusks. So all the mollusks outside of this don't bear a shell today. And if we look at the very first examples of these mollusks down in the early Cambrian, we can look at what types of minerals they possessed by looking at the shapes of the minerals been left behind in these remarkable little fossils. So in the very earliest examples, we have these very poorly constrained lamellofibula or layers of fibers. And then as we move up each of these different lineages, we see more and more complex tissues. So we see these foliated, or where you have the fibers are very carefully folded up to build the skeleton. And then tissues remarkably similar to mother of pearl, known as seminaca. And then ultimately in the Ordovician, later on, we get the evolution of mother of pearl itself, independently in gastropod mollusks and bivalve mollusks. So we can use the fossils and what we know about how mollusks build their skeletons today to build this hypothesis of increasing complexity through time. So from an organic precursor that we don't have direct fossil evidence for, because it's very difficult to fossilize things unless they have mineralized tissues. And then first of all, we get this poorly constrained layer on the inside, and then increasing layers in the early Cambrian, and ultimately the evolution of Mother of Pearl. So this is showing this pattern of increasing control over biomineralization. And I won't bore you by going through the detail of every group of fossils. I'll just give you a flavor of a few more. So here are those mollusks, and here is a similar suite of small shelly fossils that are thought to be the relatives of brachiopods. So they are a group that look a lot like bivalve mollusks. They have these two valves, but they're in their own phylum. And we see in the earliest part of the Cambrian, we have these much weakly constrained skeletons, and then we get more complex tissues as we get later on. We see a similar pattern in sponges and corals. Here are some examples of potentially the earliest corals and sponges from either the very latest Ediacaran or up into the earliest part of the Cambrian. So the Cambrian explosion was definitely driven by a whole range of different factors, but I'd like to argue that one of the most crucial steps is here. If you take out this piece of the puzzle, then it's difficult to see how everything else can happen. So that is the origin of biomineralization, of animals building skeletons. And this could only happen by the earlier acquisition of these complex gene regulatory networks and organic skeletons in the precursors of the animals that we see later on in the Cambrian. So it's a very complex story. There's an awful lot of factors at play, but I'm biased, but I'm arguing for that this is one of the most important ones involved. So finally, then I'd like to return back to this piece of art. By John Dew. So can we now answer the question posed by Professor Trilobite? Does evolution go in circles and repeat itself? Well, fundamentally, the answer to that is no. So the events that took place in the latest Ediacaran and through into the Cambrian have only happened once, and they fundamentally changed the planet. All of animal ecosystems fundamentally changed the chemistry of the environments, and the conditions were just right. We have this Goldilocks moment in this period of history. So we don't see this, I don't think we'll see another Cambrian explosion. But there is something to be said for the repetitive nature of evolution. So given the right conditions, so that was a whole bunch of soft-bodied creatures that had this organic precursor skeleton and the tools that they needed, they all independently started to build skeletons when the conditions were just right. And so we perhaps we do see some evidence of evolution repeating itself. So I'd like to finish by thanking a whole load of people and organizations that have helped me in my research at various times, and also thanking you for attention. So thank you very much.